Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford art historian, a broadcaster and a writer, and I'm your chief investigator of images. I am joined by dear friend, Professor Frank McDonough. Now, we've known each other virtually through Twitter for a long time.
Yes, that's true.
It's lovely to be in a room with you. And we're going to be talking about something very exciting today. We're doing Picasso, who has not appeared yet on the Art Detective podcast. So you've got an absolute winner of a choice here, Frank. But first off, introduce yourself.
Well, I'm Professor Frank McDonough. I suppose my unique selling point is that I'm a Scouser, but I went to Balliol College, Oxford.
Boom. I like to do that too. I grew up in Slough, but I still went to university at Oxford. Well done, you.
And I mainly write about the Third Reich, and I mainly write about the interwar period. And I've written books on the origins of the First and Second World Wars. And I wrote a biography of Sophie Scholl. Recently, I wrote a book that was very successful about the Gestapo, and I'm writing a big mega history of the period of the era of the Third Reich my next book.
And you're also, I mean, you're very modest because you're internationally recognised as somebody who sees the war period in a different way. You view it in your own unique way, don't you? The causes and the...
I think my contribution is that I sort of take the myths of the period and try and bring about what really happened. And I think I did that in the previous book on the Gestapo, where everybody had this image of the Gestapo that they beat everybody up, you know. And then in my book, I show actually they didn't beat everybody up.
Right.
They beat real targeted victims up, like Jews and communists. But if you were ordinary German, they treated you pretty well, actually.
You know,
they were trying to find ways to actually release you rather than put you in a concentration camp. So I really go in for that kind of history, you know, rooted in sources, but trying to sort of give people a kind of more nuanced approach to history, really.
Absolutely. Human beings, individuals,
exactly.
As opposed to collective myths.
And also, I'm very interested in the idea of a human being trapped in this world of the Third Reich. That's what drew me towards Sophie Scholl, an ordinary young woman, a university student, and yet she stood up to Hitler. So that's sort of... You can really identify with that.
And it's definitely the way history's going, isn't it? We're sort of over these collective group identities and we're trying to find voices in the past.
Yeah, I think we're looking for, you know, stories, individuals. What did they do? What contribution did they do? In my Gestapo book, it's sort of a lot of stories about ordinary people. You know, in that book, there are love affairs that go wrong. There are people who denounce their neighbours. There's a husband and wife who denounce each other, etc. It's that kind of, you know, it's that human sort of denunciation that's fascinating, that people would denounce people to get an advantage.
I mean, it's a complex web of emotions,
yeah.
And relationships.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that we sometimes don't appreciate when we study wartime, that it is this web of people. But that's why I adore your work, Frank, and I adore your approach. You're also fabulous on Twitter because you do your daily history, don't you? is every day it lights up.
Well, I kind of like it because I think that if you go on Twitter, and you start talking about, you know, Brexit or, you know, whatever is in the news, you know, and I when I was originally on Twitter, I did a bit of that, you know, and people would say things like, oh, give it a rest, Frank. You know, so I just do concentrate on the daily facts. I try to find some quirky facts, and you know, there are some facts there. There's a lot of research has gone into those facts.
I can tell, and the amount of time you must put into it, but I respect it and appreciate it. But also, you're wonderful.
And they're about 99.9% right as well.
Always a good thing,
which is good. But yeah.
But also, you're very good. You're very diverse, and you're constantly citing, you know, modern popular culture. But you're interested in music. You're interested, presumably, in art, which is why we're here today.
Absolutely, yeah.
And have you?
I really like modern art, actually.
Well, this is what I was going to say.
Big fan of modern art.
What sort of artists and artworks do you enjoy?
Well, you know,
personally?
Like the Dada movement and sort of those like Klee and people like that from the Weimar period. I like all of that. I like art that sort of, you've got to think about it, you know. I mean, I quite like The Unmade Bed.
I love The Unmade Bed.
I went to an exhibition in Toronto. It was a modern art gallery in Toronto. And it was based on this guy. He just does art with glass. I don't know his name. He does art with glass and sand.
Yeah.
And you could just talk about it, you know, like deconstruct it. So I quite like the kind of deconstruction of art, really. What does this mean?
Exactly.
So we've got in front of us the actual painting of Guernica by Pablo Picasso.
Well, this is it. When I said to you, Frank, what do you want to do for Art Detective? You came back immediately with Guernica, and it is iconic. It is incredibly well known, wrapped in scholarship, in complexity, in contradictory views. But I mean, it is so important as an artwork, isn't it? Why did you choose it?
I think I chose it because the overhanging theme of the interwar period, the new weapon, really. Well, there were two new weapons, really, that people worried about. One was the tank, and the other one was the aircraft. Because, okay, aircraft had been in towards the end of the First World War, but there were no really major civilian bombings. But as they said about the Second World War, you know, the bomber will always get through. It was known that if there was a Second World War, there would be bombing of civilian targets, and people thought civilians would be, you know, killed on a massive basis. So Guernica, which happened in April 1937, you know, at the height of the Spanish Civil War, you know, when Spain was sort of fighting this civil war between the Republicans, mainly on the left, that they'd been elected democratically. And who challenged them but a group of army officers led by General Francisco Franco, and he was on the other side. And this war became a massive... It was a kind of massive conflagration, sort of like I would say it's the Vietnam of the 1930s, because what happened was, you know, all kinds of people fought on both sides. You've got people like George Orwell goes and fights.
That's one of the things we forget as well. You know, you've got people coming in. They empathize. They connect.
Ernest Hemingway went to fight. You know, so you've got like sort of, you've got this amazing sort of conflict. And also remember, it's the first time that the fascist leaders, Hitler and Mussolini, get involved in a war. And on the other side, you've got the Republicans. I think you've got the Republicans. And of course, Stalin gets in on their side. So you've really got the ideological struggle of the 1930s. And what does Britain and France do? They stay neutral.
Stay neutral.
So there's the appeasement policy of 1930s. So all in one particular war, you've got sort of everything, really. And you've got the shape of things to come. I mean, it's H.G. Wells wrote a book in 1933 called The Shape of Things to Come. And in that book, he says in 1940, there'll be another war. I think he says it started by a Pole.
Good.
Who shoots, yeah, a Pole gets shot. Yeah. And what's done is that the Nazis exploit that to start the war. It's very much what happens, actually.
Good grief. I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? That you feel zeitgeists, you feel movements. And the Spanish Civil War, you're absolutely right. It is like a miniaturized version of what's to come. But it's so destructive to Spain. Its legacy is huge. I mean, I'm married
there,
to a Spaniard. And,
there.
You know, they all talk, his family, about growing up under Franco regime. And it was incredibly oppressive.
And of course, Guernica is a Basque town.
There you go.
So, you know, you couldn't have anything, you know, sort of more resonant than that. And that's why Guernica has stayed in the memory so much. And of course, Picasso, when Picasso was commissioned to make this painting by the Republican movement.
And
it was supposed to be exhibited at the World's Fair, 1937.
That's right. So it was an expression of the Republican movement on a world's platform. But what's really interesting, I found as well, was Picasso at the time when he was commissioned, he had this wonderful title of Director in Exile of the Prado, because of course he'd left in 1934, and he's working in and around France at this point. But this idea that actually people were running away from what they could see, from the fascism, from the destruction of what they could see. Paint a little bit of a picture of what it must have been like in Spain at this time, in the sort of mid-30s going into 37.
Well, I think Spain, obviously, there was this idea, you know, the fascism was on the march. And I think that, you know, Franco's movement just wouldn't accept a democratic election. As we know, Vietnam was rather similar, wasn't it? It was just rather similar. They wouldn't accept communists being elected. And in a way, Chile was the same. Yeah. So really what you've got here is something that was democratic. And on the side of democracy, the three biggest democratic countries, which are Britain, France, and America, don't get involved. They stay outside of it. So therefore, they say that because Britain and France remain neutral, it meant that the backing that they were getting from Mussolini and Hitler tipped the scales in favor of Franco. So Franco wouldn't have won the war without, actually, this Condor Legion. The Condor Legion who they instigated the attack on Guernica.
Explain a bit more about the Condor Legion.
The Condor Legion was, well, what happened was Hitler didn't openly say that he was involved in the Spanish Civil War. What he did was he created a kind of like a holding company to pretend that he called them the Condor Legion. He had this kind of holding company that was using the Luftwaffe planes. And to sort of try and suggest that he wasn't really involved in the war itself. But of course, Guernica brought it out quite clearly that these were Luftwaffe planes. And there was hell, because the Times actually said that, you know, Hitler bombs Guernica and he went mad. There was a diplomatic incident. You know, the ambassador complained to the government at the time, to the Baldwin government, and the Times was castigating, saying, he said, you know, the Luftwaffe isn't there. Who said the Luftwaffe were there? So they actually even denied that they were involved in the actual attack, which is amazing.
So let's go to April 37. Let's set the scene. We're in the Basque region. We're in a village called Guernica, which is where this event takes place. And it's a bomb, an air raid.
It's a bomb attack. It's a Luftwaffe bomb attack. It's the first major attack on civilians, you know, in the interwar period. So it really is a big event, because, you know, people are terrified, because people are worried by now. Remember, Hitler's well on the rise. He's already marched into the Rhineland in 1936. So people are frightened of Hitler, that he's on the road to war. People like Churchill are giving speeches warning of it. And on the other side, you've got people like Neville Chamberlain, the appeasers, who are saying, oh, we can't get involved in this. So in a way, you've got that kind of appeasement side, which is Britain and France standing sort of on the sidelines. And Stalin decides to get in with the Republicans. You know, and then on the one side, you've got really, you know, people say, oh, you know, in the end, the Second World War, when you look at it, was an ideological struggle between communism and National Socialism, really. Because as we know, Mussolini was basically a big poser, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Really, he had nothing behind him. You know, he said, I'll go to war with you. He said on the 9th of May, sends Hitler a letter, and he says, oh, Führer, I will go to war with you tomorrow. I'll declare war on you tomorrow. And then when he gets the letter, Hitler turns to one of his assistants. I think he turns to Ribbentrop, and he said, we don't even need his help. And he said, we know his boasting amounts to nothing.
Yeah.
And then the next day, Hitler would, you know, write a flagrant letter saying, oh, your letter moved me so much. I mean, their letters to each other, which are still in the archives, are very funny.
Are they?
Because, yeah, because Hitler was sort of like, I think you'd say, if they were a pop group, then, you know, Hitler was the Beatles and Mussolini was Oasis. Because but that's how it turned out. But it didn't start like that. Hitler started out as Oasis, turned into the Beatles, because he started out copying Mussolini and aping him.
Yeah.
And then in the end, the power shifted. And by 1940, he's incredibly obsequious to him.
Really?
Yeah.
But I mean, this is what interests me. So you've got these this power play going on over there. Franco, in many ways, what's going on with Franco and what's going on with the civil war, because it is still a civil war rather than this international thing, is it's gritty. It's guerrilla tactics. It's on the ground. It's an unpleasant form of warfare, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It goes on for 3 years. And it basically is. It starts that kind of thing that went on in Eastern Europe, this fighting, you know, this street fighting.
Exactly.
And as you said, guerrilla, you know, house to house. And we didn't really get that in the Second World War. The Second World War has two phases. The first part of the war is just the Blitzkrieg. Mm-hmm. And there's no, you know, face-to-face contact between the German soldiers. The only time they actually fight real soldiers is the Red Army in Stalingrad and places like that, where they've got them right in your face. And the truth is, for all of the power of the Wehrmacht, and people say, oh, what a fantastic army they were, they weren't that good at house-to-house fighting. Mm-hmm. The Red Army proved to be fantastic.
And that's the turning point, isn't it, essentially?
Basically, the Second World War was fought right in your face. Mm. And in the end, the Russians were good at that. They were good at that sort of man-to-man combat, you know. And there was a lot of that, but there was a lot of that in this war, you know.
Well,
and of course, it's the Basque country. Yeah. I mean, if we look at the painting, what fascinates me about this painting is that it's almost like a photograph,
right?
You know, because it's in black and white. Mm-hmm. So it's actually. And I think that was the influence of it. He was influenced by this photographic school of art.
He was, and I think the other thing is that this is one of the influences that you can see. There's actually typescript in there. There's bits of printed type, because he heard about the attack on Guernica via print.
Yeah.
And also they're getting moving images, early black and white film, and photographs in black and white. And that is something that we don't see in art. I think one of the reasons Guernica is so effective is the absence of colour. It is black, white and grey.
But also it exemplifies, there's a lot of Spanish influences here. For example, the bull.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't get anything more Spanish than the bull. Mm. And then you've got the horse.
Yeah. So and actually you've got a second horse. There's a couple of hidden objects within it.
Yeah.
There's a skull that comes out from the back of the bull.
Yeah.
But also the shape of the horse's front leg makes a bull as well.
Yeah.
So there's sort of two bulls in there. Obviously symbols of Spanish identity.
And the screaming woman. There's the screaming woman. And there's the sort of the soldier who's got, I think, is he been decapitated?
He's got his arm cut off.
That's right,
You can see the bone, and then it's still grasping a broken sword. I mean, it's so tragic.
And I think it's supposed to represent the middle of the bomb attack.
Yeah.
That these people are actually experiencing this bomb attack. I mean, you got the guy over here, he seems screaming.
Absolutely. And there is, I think, the suggestion of a plane.
Yeah.
An aeroplane flying in. Because I suppose that's one of the most terrifying things about this attack. It's coming from the air.
Yeah.
It's one of the first, one of these major bomb attacks from the air, would you say?
But it is the first major bomb attack from the air. But
good grief.
What's interesting was Picasso, of course, lived in Paris. He never went back to Spain.
No.
He lived in Paris. But of course, the controversial bit about Picasso is that he lived in Paris during the Nazi occupation.
Mm-hmm.
From what we know, he was always a communist and he remained a communist all his life. But what's interesting is that he had some friends in the German army who used to come round to his apartment. And I think one evening, one of the German officers looked at the painting and he said, did you do that? He said to Picasso. He said, no, you did that.
That's an amazing story.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend, John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
But that he is a controversial figure. He'll always be a controversial figure and deliberately ambiguous. So he says about this painting, well, all you can see, because lots of people want to know what the horse and the bull symbolize. He does a series of sketches before he does Guernica, which show Franco first of all, devouring his own horse, and then eating the bull of Spain. And I think that lots of people have said, you know, this is representing Franco and oppression.
Yeah, yeah.
But he just said, it's a horse and a bull.
Yeah, yeah.
if you see anything else, that's you.
Yeah.
Which is typical Picasso.
But also Picasso is sort of the archetypal champagne socialist, isn't
there
he? Because he was well up on commercializing his work, wasn't he? He had sort of agents and people like that when he was in Paris and Vienna. And he made a lot of money, didn't he?
Made a lot of money. And he was very clever about how he distributed through print form in particular. At the end, he was just signing canvases and signing paper. Yeah. And then anything was being put out in his name. But it gets quite tragic. But I think at this point, this is his legacy piece, isn't it? This is what people know him for. It's enormous. We should add that in.
It's very large,
3.5 meters by nearly eight meters. It's huge. And it's full of impact. As we said, I mean, it's unusual because there's no colour. In war scenes, we're used to seeing graphic blood and drama.
I think what we get from this painting, if you look at it, there's a kind of, it's the chaos of bombing. I mean, people forget, you know, when they talk about the Blitz and things like that, you know, it was psychologically really, you know, really terrifying, you know, to think that night you could be killed in a bomb attack. And then when the bomb attack happened, you know, we like to think of, oh, you know, the great plucky British spirit, but it was chaotic.
Mm.
You know, there was riots, you know, when they bombed Coventry and places like that, you know, there were riots, there was looting that went on, even down, they say, oh, you know, the lovely London Underground and all that. But, you know, all kinds
everyone's singing and drinking tea,
not if you're a woman. There was all kinds of sexual assaults going on of drunken men coming out. Imagine sort of, you know, 10,000 drunken men coming out of a pub. Going down the underground that's full of women. You imagine what happened. But we have this thing, oh, they're all there, you know, doing the Lambeth walk doing the okie cokie and all this. And what there was a lot of fights and things like that. So war is chaos, you know, war is chaos. And I think really this is the start of the really big sort of bomb attacks that we had during the Blitz, of course, in London, Liverpool, Glasgow.
I mean, I've been in a bunker in a war bunker. There was a whole sequence of war bunkers in Barcelona, which was for sequences of civil war attacks, but also bomb attacks from the air. And they are dark, scary, cold, horrible places to be. And you're right, you know, we forget the psychological impact again. We tend to get so wrapped up in battle dates and logistics. This is human suffering.
Yeah.
It's pain and it's claustrophobic. It's the discomfort and the fear of war, isn't it?
Yeah. And also the casualty rates. More people died in Blitz raids on London, certain Blitz raids, than died at Guernica. And of course, when you go on to some of the big German cities that were bombed, I'm thinking of Hamburg, you know, 400,000 people were killed. In Hamburg over about 3 or 4 days. And in 1945, of course, Dresden, 22,000 people were killed and the whole town was sort of razed to the ground. So in a way, and of course, further on from this, you've got the apocalypse of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. So in a way, I see it as a kind of, it's a, to me, it's a doorway to the horror that's going to happen in the Second World War. This is that doorway to that horror. I mean, we see it, don't we, in those paintings of the trenches in the First World War. There's a very famous paintings of a guy who did the trenches. And this is like resonance of another type of war, a modern war. Mm. Here's a modern expression of it, because this is modern art. This isn't just straightforward portrait painting. And this also points the way, doesn't it, towards the modernist period, you know. I mean, you know, that could be an album cover from the 1960s, couldn't it?
But it's because it's about a new role for art. I mean, you've got photography that captures reality. You've got film that you can capture actual physical movement. Yeah. But what Picasso is showing is that only art can show this sort of individual interpretation of pain and suffering. And by abstracting it, by making it unrealistic, it's more of a statement of humanity, a statement of you, a general feel rather than a specific moment. And it's called Guernica, and it's clearly related to the bombing, but it's a bigger statement about the suffering of war, isn't it? That's why it's got this iconic legacy.
Well, it's basically, fundamentally, it's anti-war. Mm. It's sort of a great, you know, description of anti-war.
It is.
And you would use this as an example of, you know, how art could reflect something that was anti-war in a modernist way. Mm. And that's why I think it's significant. And, of course, Picasso himself is a significant figure. You know, he's one of the figures of the 20th century. And the fact that he painted this, and I mean, we know, don't we, you know, great art, you know, suffered in the Second World War because it was pretty hard to be an artist, for example, in Eastern Europe, Poland was literally destroyed. The whole country
didn't exist.
You know, and then Russia went the same way.
Yeah.
And really, we didn't have, you know, remember, in the First World War, what we've got to remember is that there was those trenches. So behind those trenches, it was very quiet. You could do a bit of poetry.
Absolutely.
You couldn't do poetry in a tank.
rather chaotic.
Flying a Messerschmitt.
God, you know what I mean? I know.
There are no RAF poets.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. You know, you haven't got the comfort of sitting in a trench. But it's an interesting aspect of art created in times of drama and intensity and war in particular. Yeah. I think the impacts of the World Wars on art were felt after the World Wars. But we've got something that's right poised on the edge. It's coming out of one into another.
Yeah.
But also firmly rooted in this civil war that's taking place in Spain.
Yeah. And
It's of its time, but it's sort of
before its time.
Yeah. Yes.
Because it's kind of sort of projecting onto, it's almost something that should have been, it's 30 years ahead of its time in terms of its symbolism. And
it's almost pop arty in elements, which is absolutely 30 years ahead of its time. Yeah. But then there's these wonderful, I think you're right about the fact that this is essentially pacifistic. This is about peace is better than war. And there is a dove in there, and there is
could be the start of a David Bowie video, couldn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. But it's got a cinematic quality.
It's got that too.
And the fact that this is a mural. I mean, I feel movement in this. It feels energised.
Yeah.
But there's also, I mean, there's wonderful elements like the light bulb up there.
Yes.
Being the light bulb of the torturer. Yeah. The intense white heat. Conflicting with this sort of lamp that's being brought in, which is a candlelight.
Yeah.
So it's all about tension and conflict. But actually, the real thing about this is the faces, isn't it? I think that's what sticks with everybody.
I think what it is, it's the horror on the faces.
Yeah.
And even the horror of the horse
Exactly.
And the horse is a great symbol of sort of, you know, helping people in war, isn't it? You know, because so many people rode horses in war. And it's a kind of a noble beast. And the bull, of course, is very much the bullfighter and the image of Spain. And these are two very iconic nationalist symbols, aren't they?
They are, and actually, the main.
I think he's representing Franco with the bull.
You're absolutely right, I think, and the agony on the horse's face
is probably representing the Republicans. I think that's
one of the interpretations. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the way I love the articulation of it. So he's obviously applied Cubist principles, but the way that the horse's head almost tilts upwards in that gasping scream.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's the horse that's lacerated through.
That's right, in
a way, that cut in the side of the horse there is the centre of the painting. Yeah. It is
Also, even if you go before the attack happened, this was the nightmare of what might happen. You know, panic, terror, fear. You know, it's all there. It's etched across this in every way, isn't it? And it's sort of what I like about it, like you said earlier, it's the black and white.
Yeah.
See, sometimes, you know, black and white imagery can say so much more. Mm-hmm. I mean, all those great photographs of war in the 60s, you know, of the young Vietnamese girl, it's in black and white, even though colour photography is available. The photograph of the guy who's being shot in the head in the Vietnam War, it's in black and white.
Same.
You know, so some of the greatest photographs are in black and white. And I think it's the way he uses that idea of the photographic school. I think with Picasso, you know, he's such a enigmatic figure. I mean, later on, you know, people did say to him, you know, why did you stay in Nazi occupied Paris? You know, you didn't have to go back to Spain because Portugal was a neutral country.
Yeah.
Sweden was a neutral country. You know, he could have gone to America. You know, but he wouldn't have liked America because of, you know, he was a communist.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that, you know, in spite of his communism and all the rest of it, you know, he was probably one of the richest men in the world, wasn't he? I think his estate is worth billions, isn't it? His estate.
He was a celebrity. He was desirable, and he had the world at his fingertips at a time where it was in turmoil.
Yeah.
But he was bloody good. As
and he also had, you know, I mean, he wouldn't have done well in the Me Too movement. Either,
oh
would he?
No way!
So he was a bit predatory towards women, wasn't he?
And incredibly
there were, so. There was a kind of a revolving door of women that went in and out of his apartment, wasn't there?
He's a really tricky. Again, it's one of these people that we eulogise and mythologise about. And once you actually look into their personal life, it's that difficult thing of, can you ever divorce an artist's life from their work? I mean, with something like this, I think it has become almost disassociated in as much as it is iconic of war.
I think we've done that. I think now, I mean, I think with the modern world, as we move forward now, there's this idea of sort of, you know, we find out some terrible things of a person's past, so we then expunge that person from history. But some people survive, don't they? I mean, Michael Jackson, I mean, for some reason, people have forgotten all the child abuse allegations, haven't they?
It is a bit worrying, yeah.
I think, like you said, you know, Frank Sinatra, there's his, you know, his intimacy with gangsters, and then there's his wonderful voice. Where do you go with this? I find it difficult, you know, expunging something in the past where it is great art. What do we do? Do we just say, okay, this guy's flawed? Most people who are artists are quite flawed.
I think most people are
flawed. Most people are quite, yeah, exactly.
I think this is the problem.
He would
it?
Not have survived. I mean, he would not have survived the modern media.
No way.
Into him. I mean, I think if you went into his the way he treated women, I think that would be enough to damn him today.
Definitely.
There's no way that he could survive.
Oh, let alone
today.
His politics. And when we start thinking about
or war, or any of these people.
But this is it. And I think the art stands alone at times with potency. Some of his work is not that great. You know, there's multiple old Picasso prints knocking about in galleries all over the world. And some of it's mediocre.
Yeah.
But he had a skill. He had a lightness of touch. So the one I always think of is where he just draws the suggestion of the lady's bottom with a line, single, you know, one line. And just that skill, that stroke, is what makes him a distinctly excellent
artist.
And
a lot
artist.
Of people found a lot of his later work quite crude and pornographic, didn't they?
Yeah.
And it's, you do look at some of it, and I mean, you know, you're an art expert and I'm not, but some of it I find inexplicable.
Yeah.
You know,
well, he also loves to court controversy and to court. He created a myth around his work. So that's like with Guernica. He won't say, he'll say, it's a bull and a horse. But he knows he's written symbolism into this.
Yeah.
And he's deliberately obtuse in terms of giving people what they want in answers so that they go back to it and reinterpret it. He's clever. He's canny. He's good at his PR.
Well, it's like with poetry, isn't it? People, they get great depth out of poetry. And a lot of poetry is just straightforward writing. There's no great depth. to some poetry. Mm. And then when you start reading into it, you can read a lot into a lot of poetry. But the poet, if you got the poet there, yeah. he'd probably say, I wasn't really saying that.
But this is the beauty of, like you were saying
it's
at
like
the beginning.
It's like that Woody Allen film, isn't it, Annie Hall, where he starts going on about, Marshall McLuhan's theories of the media and all that. And he gets Marshall McLuhan and brings him forward and he says, you don't know anything about my theory.
Yeah.
And then Woody Allen says, wouldn't it be great if life was like this?
Yeah.
In a way, it's like, it's like this. Wouldn't it be great if we could get Picasso in and he'd say, what are you two talking?
Yeah, but he wouldn't say that's the problem with Picasso. He'd tell you the opposite. He's cantankerous. But it's interesting, isn't it? It's something you were saying earlier, Frank, about where we are in terms of coming through modern art, the modernism movement in general and how it affected academia and scholarship and thought. We're in a point now where I think we do have to take individual viewpoints. We look at this, we think Picasso, but actually we're seeing a mirror of ourselves an awful lot of the time, aren't we? In art, in music, in all these things, that what we learn a lot about is ourselves and how we perceive. And that's the beauty of looking at art.
What's also significant about this is the way that bombing has gone on. Mm. I mean, even though we proved that bombing didn't win the Second World War, it didn't have a major effect on the Second World War, it was boots on the ground, it was the Red Army in Berlin, it was people on the D-Day beaches, it was those people fighting on the ground that won the war. And strategic bombing was terrible. I think that the British strategic bombing, they bombed the wrong towns.
Good.
That's how bad it was. And at the end of the war, the Americans bombed four cities in Holland that were the wrong place, so you've got that. And then of course there was that thing in Vietnam where they thought they could win the war. They didn't want the boots on the ground, so they started to bomb with napalm and so on. Recently we've had the bombing, we can win the Iraq war with just bombing. Since subsequently we found that the guerrilla tactics, we still go in for this bombing when we know the bombing, we absolutely know, everyone who's a military historian or an historian of all the wars that we've had, bombing has never won a single war. It's not even the Battle of Britain. We think that we won, but it was an inconclusive end. There was no winner. We weren't going to defeat Britain by surviving bombing. Yeah. We weren't going to defeat Germany by surviving bombing. We had to get boots on the ground and go over there, and the Red Army had to go over there. So I think that we got this in our modern society. The bombing is still there, and we are still, I think, now, if you show photographs of children and civilians, in hospitals and all the rest of it after bombing, people balk at it.
Yeah.
You've still got that Guernica factor where once people see bombing and they see the effects of it, and of course, you get these reporters, they don't want to really show the aftermath of the bombing. They'd rather just say, oh, we bombed, a chemical works. They don't want to show the hospital where all the people who actually, were injured and killed and children and all the rest of it. Because then we start to say, oh, God, yeah. I didn't back that.
But it's the spectre of death, isn't it? And I think that's what the Picasso's image shows too. It's this new spectre of an inexplicable, faceless death that comes to you from the sky, and you don't even know where it's going to hit, and it's absolutely going to take out anyone, regardless whether you're guilty, innocent. It's indiscriminate. But as you say, it's a fantasy as much as it is a reality. But it hovers in people's consciousness today as well, the fear of it coming. And I think that's what makes the image so strong and powerful, don't you reckon?
I think that that's a very good point. I think that we start off with this nightmare of bombing. And we all know, bombing is terrible. We wouldn't like to have gone through that bombing, in the Second World War. And it was terrible. What was different about the bombing that happened and the start was here in Guernica is that previously it was soldiers who fought in wars and men. What we forget is all the people dying in the First World War, the vast majority of them were soldiers,
absolutely,
male soldiers who died. Now, here we've got something different. Women and children and old people were the sufferers of civilian wars. So what you've got is, and that's why there's a morality tale here. Even when we go through the Bomber Harris business about, Churchill said when we started bombing, Hamburg and Dresden, well, they started it and they're going to reap what they sow now. you know, and two wrongs don't make a right, you know. But we know, don't we, that, you know, when we look at the civilian casualty rates, you know, 600,000 German women and children and old people were killed in those bomb attacks, which didn't actually, even the Dresden attack, which is like 2 or 3 months before the end of the war, a war we were definitely going to win. You know, we were definitely going to win that war, and they were going to cave in, and Hitler was never going to surrender because we were bombing. He didn't care about his own civilian population. So I think the bombing resonates, and I think that's why this painting is so important, because it gives us something that's, it's the past in the present.
Well, this is it. And I think what you've got in this image, you've got the dead soldier in the foreground who is almost like a knight, a medieval knight, trained in combat, arms severed because it's not about one-to-one combat anymore. Yeah. And then you've got the woman and the child, and this is equal 50-50 male-female ratio.
Yeah.
And everybody is suffering.
Yeah,
and you are
right.
Right. That is what has given this legacy, isn't it?
Yeah.
God, it's good. Frank, listen, we have talked for ages. We've got to wind up, unfortunately. What an amazing experience talking to you. But also, this is a real lesson in why art history is such an exciting discipline. We've talked at length with one image, and that is the power of a really impressive artwork, isn't it? It could just take you on these journeys into the past. I have loved talking to you. Thank you.
I've loved talking to you.
What's your Twitter handle so people can follow you?
Well, it's F for Frank, X for Xavier, because that's my middle name.
Oh.
And then MC is the start of my surname, McDonough. And it's 1957.
There you go.
They'll
get that. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.